From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. A thousand points of light is one of George Bush's most famous lines, but before those words came out of the president's mouth, they came out of Peggy Noonan's typewriter. On this edition of Fresh Air, Peggy Noonan tells about her years as a speechwriter for Ronald Reagan and George Bush. Also today, a new take on a horror classic. Novelist Valerie Martin tells us about her new version of Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde. Book critic John Leonard reviews the new novel from economist John Kenneth Galbraith. And for Valentine's Day, novelist Tom Robbins on The Kiss. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Sharon Green. An important breakthrough, that's how President Bush describes the Soviet Union's agreement on his troop cut proposal for Europe. The president said the development clears away a major obstacle to a conventional weapons treaty. The president said the troop agreement and a separate pact to speed German reunification caught him by surprise. NATO and Warsaw Pact foreign ministers resolved both issues during a just-completed conference in Ottawa. As German reunification comes closer to reality, a new poll in Czechoslovakia shows citizens there are wary of the idea. NPR's Deborah Amos reports from Prague.
Well, Czechoslovakia's president has said publicly that reunification is a matter for the Germans to decide. In a poll published today in Prague, 50% said that other nations should be consulted. 44% said reunification may be a threat to European security. The sample was small, only 770 polled, but the results are an indication that the issue is a sensitive one here. After the war, many Germans were forced to leave Czechoslovakia. Last month, President Václav Havel apologized for the treatment of innocent Germans. The country's Catholic cardinal concurred, but asked for a German apology. This may happen next month, when a major West German political figure will attend an observance of the anniversary of the German occupation of Czechoslovakia. In Prague, this is Deborah Amos.
The Executive Committee of the African National Congress is meeting in Zambia for the first time since South Africa's ban on the organization was lifted earlier this month. As the BBC's Patricia Golding reports, Nelson Mandela is due to arrive there later this week.
Discussions focus on the restructuring of the organization, both inside and outside South Africa. It is still not clear how long this executive meeting will last, but it is expected to be over before the weekend. Earlier, the head of the ANC's International Affairs Department, Mr. Thabo Mbeki, said firm decisions could be expected. Privately, senior ANC members have admitted they were caught off guard by the speed of recent events and know they have to respond quickly in order not to lose ground. The meeting is expected to focus on what form this response should take and whether the ANC is prepared to give ground on its conditions for negotiations. Mr. Mandela's future role within the ANC and the question of the armed struggle will also be discussed.
The BBC's Patricia Golding. Colombian law enforcement officials today rejected the latest peace gesture by powerful drug traffickers. On the eve of the four-nation anti-drug summit in Cartagena, drug lords revealed the locations of three huge cocaine laboratories reportedly capable of processing 44,000 pounds of cocaine a month. A national police colonel called the surrender of the labs a propaganda ploy that won't affect the government's crackdown on the drug trade. President Bush leaves Washington tomorrow for Colombia. Prices were higher on Wall Street. The Dow Industrials rose less than a point to close at 2624.32. This is NPR News. After a two-year court fight, Indian activist Eddie Hatcher today was sentenced to 18 years in prison for taking the staff of a Robeson County, North Carolina newspaper hostage in 1988. Adam Hochberg reports from Raleigh.
Hatcher and fellow Indian activist Timothy Jacobs claimed they masterminded the hostage siege to bring attention to corruption they said existed in the county government. Those charges of corruption never have been proven, but some members of the North Carolina Indian community say local officials discriminate against minorities and are involved in the drug trade. In 1988, Hatcher and Jacobs' lawyers persuaded a federal jury the siege was justified for that reason, and the jury found the men not guilty of hostage taking. Today's court proceeding was at the state level, and Hatcher struck a plea bargain, pleading guilty in return for an 18-year prison sentence. He could have faced more than 400 years behind bars. For National Public Radio, I'm Adam Hochberg in Raleigh, North Carolina.
Southern California beaches awash with crude oil have gotten more goo because of gale-force winds trailing a Pacific storm. Skimmer boats had to suspend operations, leaving the bulk of the cleanup to workers on the beach. Pollution from last week's tanker spill off Huntington Beach came ashore for the first time in Balboa, 10 miles away. A light oily sheen was reported along the coast from Lower Boca, that's Bolsa Chica State Beach, to Newport Beach, but the Coast Guard said very little of the spilled crude remains in the water. The American trader, leased by British Petroleum, dumped 400,000 gallons of oil after apparently being punctured by its own anchor last week. A Delta rocket launched today from Cape Canaveral successfully deployed two satellites. The $300 million flight is part of the Strategic Defense Initiative, or Star Wars Missile Defense Research Program. One of those satellites deployed today will be used to determine the effects of atmospheric pollution and distortion on laser beams. The other, flying at a lower orbit, will test an experimental laser mirror. I'm Sharon Green, NPR News, in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. George Bush described America as a nation of communities filled with thousands of voluntary helping organizations, 1,000 points of light. Ronald Reagan said the Contras were the moral equal of our founding fathers. These are just two of the vivid, often controversial lines written by my guest, Peggy Noonan. She joined the Reagan White House as a speechwriter in 1984. She wrote President Reagan's address commemorating the 40th anniversary of D-Day and his speech after the space shuttle Challenger blew up, when he said the astronauts had slipped the surly bonds of Earth to touch the face of God. She later wrote for Bush's presidential campaign. Noonan has given up speechwriting and has stepped out from behind the presidents to tell about writing for them. Her new memoir is called What I Saw at the Revolution, A Political Life in the Reagan Era. Presidents don't publicly credit their speechwriters at the conclusion of an address. I asked Noonan if there are rules of etiquette on when it's appropriate for speechwriters to take credit for what they've written.
I don't know. That's all changing, you know. In the Reagan era, it was not uncommon for reporters, after a major speech, not an unimportant one, but a major one, or sometimes a particularly striking one, to run around a great deal and find out who wrote it, and to print it. In the Reagan era, as never before, with one short exception being the Nixon era, when Agnew was going after the media, and the speechwriters all of a sudden gained prominence there because everyone was fascinated by who wrote nattering nabobs of negativism and such. But in the Reagan era, as never before, I think the speechwriter became an object of attention, partly because it was a rhetorical presidency in many respects. I think partly because there was a certain antipathy to Reagan among the opinion leaders in a way, and so they always wanted to know who was working for him and why and such.
Are we supposed to suspend disbelief when we hear a presidential address and assume that, although we really know it was a speechwriter, that the president is talking his own words?
Well, I don't know if suspend disbelief is the phrase I would use. The thing you have to know is that the president always owns the words he speaks. Whether or not he typed out a particular sentence is almost irrelevant. By the time he has looked at it, okayed it, made the decision on whether or not, you know, sometimes there are arguments over sentences. It'll come down to his making a decision sometimes on which way he's going to go. By the time he gets up and says it, it is history and it is his. An example being, say, President Bush saying in his acceptance speech, "Read my lips." You know, you can say Peggy Noonan and Roger Ailes and Bob Teeter. So many people were his advisors, and that's really sort of inauthentic and has to do with what they think is right. But the fact is, aside from the fact that Bush worked hard on that address, the fact is, if the sad day comes in 1992, when President Bush, unlike him, does something wrong, and he raises taxes, nobody on NBC, ABC, or CBS is going to play the soundbite of George Bush saying, "Read my lips," and come out of it saying, "We're mad at Ailes and Noonan and Teeter." What they're going to say is, "Bush has done something wrong. Those were his words. He owns them forever." They get the benefit for them, and they also get the they get the criticism for them when they don't work out.
Well, you originated the idea, the phrase "read my lips," right?
Originated.
Wrote it.
Oh, what a nice verb. The phrase "read my lips" was in Vice President Bush's acceptance speech, and had to do with his directive to make it unambiguously clear that he would not raise taxes, stated in a way that could not be interpreted as, oh, he left himself some wiggle room. Maybe he will raise taxes. He just wanted to be real clear about it.
You wrote the line.
Well, I'm told by Ted Sorensen the appropriate answer to the question, who wrote Ask Not, is Ask Not. So I think I will quote Ted Sorensen and keep going.
Okay, but let me say, it's fair to say you had something to do with the line, right? Okay.
Well, it's fair to say I worked on the speech with Bush. How about that?
Okay. Now, the kindler, gentler nation was in one of the speeches that you wrote, but you explained that it was actually something that Bush had said when you were with him, and you wrote it down and decided to use it in the speech.
He used words like that a lot. Mm-hmm. His the images he used when he was talking with me were very interesting. You know, he'd talk about the things that the images he had from the vice presidency. Once he described holding a child in Ethiopia or Somalia, which had been famine-ridden at the time, and had met a child who was starving to death, very much a victim of the famine, and had picked the child up, rocked him in his arms, and he told me how thin he was, and he talked about children, and repeatedly with me he returned to themes like that. He had given me a whole list of words that mattered very much to him. I put it in the book, and at the moment I forget specifically what words they were, but they were words like decency, kindness, caring, things like that. And as I worked with him, I kept listening to him, and I kept hearing, you know, this is different. This is not how Reagan talks. This is a very different sort of thing. And those words came very much out of those meetings. Did you notice, by the way, you said kindler instead of kinder?
No, I didn't. Did I say that?
Yes, you said kindler, gentler nation, which I say now, too. Everybody does, and I don't know why we do. We all add an L to kinder.
Gee.
A small point, but it's fascinating. Everybody does now.
Gee, I was totally unconscious of that.
Yeah, it's a funny thing.
My guest is Peggy Noonan, and she's written speeches for President Reagan and for George Bush when he was a candidate for the presidency, and her experiences as a speechwriter are recounted in her book, What I Saw at the Revolution. When you're writing a presidential speech, the speech has to convey policy. Who is determining finally which part of the policy gets conveyed, how strongly it gets conveyed, you know, what the spin on the policy is going to be? There are so many people with investments, you know, in having the policy stated in the way that they want it.
Mm-hmm.
And you describe in your book, speech writing, you say, was the place where the administration got invented every day.
Mm-hmm.
So
it's where policy disputes got worked out eventually, because they had to be. We had to put the words on the paper,
mm-hmm.
you know?
So who was included in your process of writing and in expressing what the policy was?
Depends on the speech. Depended on what the subject was and how important the speech was. If it's a big speech on foreign affairs, state weighed in, and NSC, and sometimes someone from OMB, and all sorts of people would weigh in, and there were real fights. Sometimes there'd be a disagreement between NSC and state, and they'd work it out at a private meeting and then come to us with what they'd decided. Sometimes it was worked out. Nobody could quite agree on it, but a speech had to be in on a certain deadline, so you'd do your best, write it, and it would go to the president in the limousine on the way to the address, you know, and he'd make the final decision on what he was going to say and what paragraph was going to be dropped and what paragraph was going to be added. So it was interesting, you know, there were lots of wrestling matches, you know. It's just not like Lincoln sitting in the back with an envelope and a pen anymore.
Is there an example from one of the speeches you wrote of how policy had to be restated because of the editorial structure?
I'm not sure what you mean. Because of the staffing process and such?
Yeah.
A million little examples, I guess. I can remember once working on the address at Pointe du Hoc that President Reagan gave at the 40th anniversary of D-Day. And someone at State or NSC, I forget at the moment, decided that we should sort of stop the speech in its flow for a bit and insert a paragraph on Soviet losses during the war. I resisted very hard for a number of reasons, one of which was that the Soviets weren't at D-Day, and it wasn't a D-Day wasn't a story about Soviet losses during the war, and we were putting that paragraph in for blatantly political reasons, which I thought harmed the sort of literature of the speech. But very often, you know, you'd write a speech that you thought was really good in the Reagan White House, and people would sometimes say, well, that's pretty good, but let's add this, 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 and this. And it was always like clunky policy stuff, and they'd take out literature to make room for the policy because a speech can only be just so long, like maybe 20 minutes. So you keep taking out literature, putting in policy, taking out literature, putting in policy. By the end, it can sound like some dry bureaucratic memo, you know? So I can remember fighting off the state or NSC fellows on the Soviet reference long enough so that it was not included in the president's final text, so that when he finally did write it in, if he chose to write it in, he wouldn't be able to remove any of the literature, and neither would anybody else, more to the point, Bud McFarlane or George Shultz in the helicopter, actually, on the way to D-Day. So there were times when you'd do a little dancing that way. I got a little bit tense sometimes, you know?
Well, you know, you're talking about the problem of taking out literature and putting in policy and having it read like a bureaucratic memo.
Yeah.
But on the other hand, do you ever feel that presidential speechmaking becomes too much like a commercial for the campaign, that there's copy that's sometimes like slogans for an advertising campaign and sometimes perhaps not enough emphasis on what the policy really is, even in State of the Union addresses, which seem to be more about crowd-pleasing now than about discussing policy.
Well, you know, in the State of the Union, the president did say some serious policy things. In the presidency, I don't think it's as much a problem as in a campaign. A campaign can be a most disheartening thing to see because, in fact, you get to a certain point in a campaign where there are so many forces that converge that keep the candidate from saying meaningful things. You know, as in the knowledge that each day is going to be reduced to a soundbite and a photo op by the media. Each day is going to be reduced to a minute 30 piece on the Brokaw show or Jennings or Rather. And since that's what most Americans are going to see of the campaign, you do have to keep your mind on making sure not too many extraneous things happen on a given day during a campaign, which means not too many extraneous or original thoughts, which means it can all get very dull when, in fact, a major campaign should smack of intellectual vitality. You know, it should sound like democracy, which is a constant argument. And instead, increasingly, we've been seeing since the 70s, they are increasingly tedious with, you know, speeches, balloon drops, the same old stuff. I don't know any way around it, since if you step on your own lines and you don't do the right soundbite or the right balloon drop, you're going to suffer for it at night on the evening news.
Let's take a break, and then we'll talk some more. My guest is Peggy Noonan. As a speechwriter for President Reagan and presidential candidate George Bush, she was responsible for some of their more memorable lines. She's written a book called What I Saw at the Revolution, A Political Life in the Reagan Era. This is Fresh Air.
Fresh Air is produced live at WHYY in Philadelphia and distributed by National Public Radio.
Peggy Noonan is my guest. We're talking about speeches she's written for George Bush and Ronald Reagan. It's the subject of her new book, What I Saw at the Revolution. You know, I sometimes wonder when I'm at home and, you know, watching the president on TV and say it's, you know, it's President Reagan, and everybody would say, President Reagan, the great communicator. And he's reading lines that were written for him. He's telling jokes that somebody else came up with for him. I mean, what are we really seeing now when we see a president give an address? It's almost like person they're reading the copy is almost the feeling you can get.
Look, you know, he was known as the great communicator from the late 70s. When, you know, in the 70s, he was still writing his own stuff. And, you know, he started out, this is something about the power of speechmaking. He started out in 64. He put himself on the national map, Reagan, by a speech that was known in-house in the White House as The Speech. It was his 1964 speech for Barry Goldwater, which was really a crucial speech, not only in his own career, but but was very helpful to Goldwater in the West. When you see a president standing up and making a speech now, what you're seeing is what that president has decided to say about any given issue, any given subject. That's every time a president does a speech, in a way, he's throwing down the gauntlet. He's saying, this is where I stand right now. Sometimes the speech is funny, is fuzzy, and you're not quite sure where they stand. That usually suggests that they're not quite sure either. I happen to think speechwriters in modern White Houses are a little too separated from presidents. It was true in the Carter White House, was true in the Reagan White House, in the Ford White House, I'm sure, also. They're a little too separated from the president and ought to work more closely, as, say, Judge Rosenman could with FDR in the 40s and Robert E. Sherwood did with FDR, where they all sat there at the table sometimes together. But to take it from that speechwriters are too far from their principles these days to, oh, it's all utterly inauthentic, he's just an actor, they gave him the words, he stood there and he said them, that's just not the way it is either, you know? Ronald Reagan had to stand by everything he ever said, and did.
About Ronald Reagan, in your book you write, he was a modest man with an intellect slightly superior to average. Were there things that you would write for him or say to him that you felt he didn't quite comprehend?
No, never anything that he didn't comprehend. I sometimes made poor cultural references. I always tried to think in terms of where he came from and what his experiences were, so I didn't make all that many cultural references and stuff, but I must tell you that I am the speechwriter who turned to the head of the speechwriting shop and said, oh, go ahead, use the Bruce Springsteen quote in a campaign speech in 1984, which is really dumb, and the press gagged. You know, and poor Reagan said on the plane on the way there, who is this fellow? You know, so that was really dumb. I could make awful mistakes like that with him, but if you mean did he have a low IQ and I had a high IQ and did I have to translate simple words for him, no, that's just not the way it was. He was a bright man. As I say, this was not an intellectual, President Reagan, but he was smart.
Well, did you ever find it discomforting to have a president with what you describe as a slightly more intelligent than average sense?
Yeah, slightly superior to the average in terms of, I think, your basic IQ stuff. It may be rude of me to say that, but there you are. But he had first-rate common sense. He had a first-rate kind of sensibility. And he had characterological things that guided him and moved him very much as a leader, in a way as Churchill did and FDR did. Oliver Wendell Holmes said of FDR, second-rate intellect, first-rate judge of character. You know, that was interesting. I happen to think a lot of our best presidents have not exactly been intellectuals, but had some extra spark having to do with wisdom, common sense, a kind of easygoing, a sort of historical view, a broad historical view. So there you are.
I don't know if you'll see this as a paradox. It struck me as one that you've written for the two presidents who were, quote, pro-family in their platform. And when you were writing for them during most of those years that you were a single woman, so busy she hardly had time for family life. And then you were married for a while, had a baby, soon separated from your husband. It seems to me your life hasn't been the kind of typical, you know, nuclear family type of life. Did you see that as paradoxical at all?
I guess so. Maybe ironic, maybe paradoxical. I don't know. I see it as very 80s, actually. I guess I would say, you know, I wrote about the family so often, oddly enough, more often with Reagan than with Bush. It was a very constant theme with Reagan. And most of the time when I was writing about it, I did not have a family of my own and was only close with the family that I came from. When I was writing for Bush, I did have a family, and yet somehow I think, unless he was clearly dictating, I want you to put this in and this in about my family and me in Texas in the old days, we didn't write that much about it. And I sometimes, you know, I read over the old speeches and the importance of the family and stuff like that, and it has a certain poignant quality to me.
You're saying that sarcastically?
No, not at all.
Oh, okay.
That was my poignant face, but you didn't see it.
Did it ever feel hypocritical to write some of the pro-family things, knowing that, you know, Reagan was the first divorce president, that the Reagan family wasn't on speaking terms with one of their children at various times?
Oh, no. First of all, when I was writing for Reagan, I did not have all that much insight. If you can remember 84, 85, I didn't know too much about his family, really, and didn't. I thought that he was very close. I can remember a rumor in the White House that he was particularly close with his daughter, Patty. You know, so there were always such rumors, and some are true and some are not. No, Reagan saw the family as the nucleus of society, and I think he is correct. Was he also at the same time a divorced man, our first divorced parent? Yes.
Is there anything you wish you hadn't written that backfired in a way you hadn't intended?
I was responsible for the phrase, the moral equal or moral equivalent, I can't remember which it was, of the founding fathers for the Contras. And it was on the directive of Reagan, through Pat Buchanan, that I compare the Contras to the founding fathers and also to the French resistance. But the way I put it left the president open to a lot of sniping from enemies, from the press, from the political opposition. And if I'd been neater with my words, that wouldn't have happened. You know, and that was sloppy, and it was on my part. The idea wasn't wrong, but the execution was.
What was wrong with the execution?
Oh, if you say something ringing like, they are the moral equal to the founding fathers. Well, you know, in fact, what you mean is, like the founding fathers, they are fighting a huge power very much against the odds, very much on their own. They're underarmed. They're underfed. You know, they're having their own prolonged valley forge down there. There are a number of points you could make. But if you just say they're the moral equal of the angels who wrote our Bill of Rights, you leave yourself open to being, well, you've just overstated the case. You know, sometimes you overstate a case and you can make it sound stronger, but sometimes you overstate a case and you totally undermine it through overstatement, and that I think, was one example of it.
Why aren't you writing speeches anymore?
Oh, there's nothing I am qualified to do in a White House but write speeches, and I've already done that, you know? I'm getting on a little bit. Arthur Schlesinger says nobody should write speeches who's over 40, and when he said that to me, I was struck by it, and I thought, wow, that's true.
Well, why not, though? I mean, our presidents are usually way over 40.
Yeah, I know. Because a speechwriter has to bring a continual excitement and almost an innocence to the job. You know, speechwriters have to write about democracy, for instance, in ways that make that subject sound very exciting. You know, with most people, if you're very good at your job, you can write about democracy in an exciting way about 7 or 8 times. But about the 9th or 10th, you've more or less said it. You know? You've shot what you had to shoot on democracy. There is a youthfulness to it and an innocence and a sense of discovery to good speeches and good speech writing that after a while, you simply lose if you've been doing it too long. Also, eventually you're a grown-up and you want, if you're going to stay a writer, you want to write in your own voice, you know? It's time after a while. So it was time for me.
Well, Peggy Noonan, I thank you very much for talking with us.
Hey, thank you, Terry. This was fun. Thanks.
Peggy Noonan's new book is What I Saw at the Revolution, A Political Life in the Reagan Era. It's published by Random House. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Next time, the Soviet Union's leading political commentator, Vladimir Posner, he became the favorite guest of TV talk shows in the U.S., representing the Soviet point of view. I hope you can join us.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio. We'll be right back.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde is a classic story about the inner war between good and evil. Novelist Valerie Martin has given a new twist to the story. Her version of Jekyll and Hyde is seen through the eyes of Dr. Jekyll's maid. Coming up, Valerie Martin on the dark side of the human psyche. Also, book critic John Leonard reviews A Tenured Professor, the new novel by economist and pundit John Kenneth Galbraith. And from novelist Tom Robbins, some thoughts about kissing. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
For National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Ann Taylor. President Bush will attend a six-hour meeting tomorrow in Colombia, along with the presidents of that country, Peru, and Bolivia, in what is called an anti-drug summit. Police and military officials in Cartagena said this afternoon that the cocaine labs surrendered by drug traffickers contained no processed cocaine and had not been used for some time. The officials also said that they have no reason to believe that the four presidents attending tomorrow's meeting are under any threat of attack. Leslie Werpsa has more on the story.
The public may have been impressed when Colombian drug traffickers turned over three huge coke labs in the Urabá jungle yesterday, but police and military chiefs said today that the complex was obsolete. A police chief said, though, that officials have not yet inspected the labs. Authorities also said that traffickers' offers for peace are not sincere, and they vowed to continue repressive measures against the drug barons. But the head of Colombia's secret police, General Miguel Massa, warned that unless more concerted efforts are reached between producer and consumer countries, whipping the drug trade will be difficult. Meanwhile, Colombian President Virgilio Barco and Bolivian President Victor Paz Zamora arrived in Cartagena this afternoon. But Peru's president, Alan Garcia, won't land in Cartagena until tomorrow morning. He reportedly was offended that the Latin American guests were expected to arrive a day earlier to receive U.S. President George Bush. For National Public Radio, I'm Leslie Werpsa in Cartagena.
U.S. officials believe that two kidnapped Americans in Colombia are still being held there by leftist guerrillas. Yesterday, there were reports that one of the two men had been released and the other would be freed shortly. Attorneys for Manuel Noriega say that they are afraid critical intelligence documents seized during the U.S. invasion of Panama may have been turned over to the government of Panama. Jeff White reports.
Steve Cohen, one of Noriega's attorneys, told a U.S. magistrate Wednesday afternoon that he has information that all of the files confiscated from the headquarters of the Panamanian Investigations Department may not be in the U.S. government's possession. The Investigations Department is similar to the FBI in the United States. Collins said he fears U.S. military forces might be turning over certain items to the Panamanian rather than the U.S. government. And Collins said those items are critical to Noriega's defense since they show his intelligence connections to the United States. A federal court order requires the U.S. government to keep all items that have been confiscated until Noriega's attorneys have a chance to review them and decide if they want to use them when the case goes to trial. For National Public Radio, I'm Jeff White in Miami.
In New York City on Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrials closed up less than a point to close at 2,624.32 on volume of 138 million shares. Trading was moderate as advancing issues led declines 7-6. This is NPR News.
This is Fresh Air. We have a Valentine for you. You may know Tom Robbins as the author of the novels Still Life with Woodpecker, Even Cowgirls Get the Blues, Another Roadside Attraction, and Jitterbug Perfume. Well, he's also written the introduction to a new book of photographs called A Kiss is Just a Kiss. It's based on an exhibition that San Francisco art dealer Bruce Velick put together, a collection of classic photographs of people mouth-to-mouth and cheek-to-cheek, lovers, friends, and family. Robbins has written a meditation on the kiss, and he's going to read some of it for us.
Kissing is our greatest invention. On the list of great inventions, it ranks higher than the thermos bottle in the Airstream trailer, higher even than room service, probably because the main reason room service was created was so that people could stay in bed and kiss without starving. Mirrors are a marvelous invention as well, yet their genesis didn't require a truckload of imagination. The looking glass being merely an extension of pond surface, made portable and refined. Kissin, on the other hand, didn't imitate nature so much as it restructured it. Kissin molded the face into a new shape called the pucker, and then, like a renegade fruit welder, soldering scoops of musk melon to halves of cherries, it combined puckers, made them compatible, interchangeable, malleable, and then animated them. Thomas Edison, turn off your dim bulb and take a hike. Tradition informs us that Kissin, as we know it, was invented by medieval knights for the utilitarian purpose of determining whether their wives had been tapping the mead barrel while the knights were away on crusades. If history is accurate for once, the kiss began as an osculatory wiretap, or oral snoop, a kind of alcoholic chastity belt after the fact. Form is not always faithful to function, however, and eventually, Kissin for Kissin's sake became popular in the courts, spreading to tradesmen, peasants, and serfs. And why not? For kissing is fun, and kissing is sweet. It was as if all the atavistic sweetness remaining in civilized, Christianized Western man were funneled into kissing and kissing alone. Kissing is the glory of the human species. All animals copulate, but only humans kiss. Parakeets rub beaks? Sure they do. But only little old ladies who murder school children with knitting needles to steal their lunch money so that they can buy fresh kidneys for kitty cats would place bird billing in the realm of the true kiss. There are primatologists who claim that apes exchange oral affection. But from here, the sloppy smacks of chimps look pretty rudimentary. They're probably just checking to see if their mates have been into the fermented bananas. No random beast-to-beast snout friction may give narrators of wildlife films an opportunity to plumb new depths of anthropomorphic cuteness, but it doesn't cut the cherub-flavored mustard in the osculation department. Psychologists claim that talking to pets is a socially acceptable excuse for talking to ourselves. That may say something interesting about those of you who kiss your pets, but you shouldn't let it stop you. Smooch your bulldog if you're so inclined. Bust your sister, your brother, your grandpa, and anybody's bouncing baby. No kiss is ever wasted, not even on the lottery ticket kiss for luck. Kiss trees, favorite books, bowling balls. Old Jews sometimes kiss their bread before eating it, and those are good kisses too. They resonate in the ether. The best kisses, though, are those between lovers, because those are the consequential ones. The risky ones, the transformative ones, the ones that call the nymphs and satyrs back to life, the many-layered kisses that we dive into as into a fairy tale frog pond or the warm whirlpool of our origins. The fact that we enjoy watching others kiss is probably some sort of homing instinct. In any case, it explains the popular appeal of Hollywood and Paris. Who can forget the elastic thread of saliva that for one brief but electrifying second connected Yvonne DiCarlo to Dan Duryea in Black Bart. And Joni Mitchell's line, "In France they kiss on Main Street," set thousands of the romantically intrigued to pack in their bags for Orly. We are drawn to that strange galactic light that surrounds all who doth embrace, even more than we are drawn to the wonders of nature. For ultimately, what good are mountains and moons except as backdrops for lovers? And where would lovers be without the kiss? No other flesh like lip flesh. No meat like mouth meat. The musical clink of tooth against tooth. The wonderful curiosity of tongues.
Tom Robbins reading from his Introduction to A Kiss is Just a Kiss, edited by Bruce Velick and published by Harmony Books. Tom Robbins' fifth novel, Skinny Legs and All, will be out this April. is Fresh Air. Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde is the classic horror story by Robert Louis Stevenson. The story has been retold in 4 movie adaptations. Roman Polanski is considering adding a 5th with an adaptation of Valerie Martin's new novel, Mary Riley. Valerie Martin tells the story of Jekyll and Hyde from the perspective of Dr. Jekyll's young maid, Mary Riley. In the original story, the maid was a very minor character. Valerie Martin is the author of several works of fiction and teaches creative writing at the University of Massachusetts in Amherst. Before we discussed Martin's new book, I asked her to refresh our memories of Stevenson's Jekyll and Hyde.
The basic premise is that a scientist who is plagued by a feeling of division in his own personality, that is, he both wants to do good in the world and be respected, has another disposition. He calls it a gaiety of disposition. We never know what it is that he does, but he's ashamed of it. And so it becomes a daydream of his that he could separate these two personalities, and then the good one could go forward and do really good work, and the wilder one, he doesn't really describe what sorts of things he would do, but he wouldn't plague the other personality, the good personality, with his desires to do things that at the very least are antisocial. And so through his chemical experiments, he derives a way of doing this, and this second personality not only acts differently but looks differently than he does, so much so that no one who looked at Mr. Hyde, the destructive personality, would ever connect him with the good Dr. Jekyll. And once his personality is out, Dr. Jekyll thinks everything will be fine, until he finds he has to take more and more of the chemical he takes less and less of the chemical to affect the transformation, and finally the transformation begins to happen without benefit of chemical, and he is at pains to keep Mr. Hyde in.
What was it about the story of Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde that made you want to reconsider it?
One thing I think that attracted me to it was the absence of women. And the idea that this is a study of good and evil in which no woman is held to blame, which I think is unusual in literature. I was attracted to the method that Stevenson uses, which is, it's a very short book. He manages to do a lot and particularly create a lot of atmosphere in a brief space. I think I'm attracted to his worldview, and I think I share it. His notion that vanity is the chief danger for people who would be reformers or who do good in the world, and that, in fact, that very desire may be somewhat dangerous. I think I agree with that. And I remember the first time I read the book, I was attracted to Jekyll's statement that although he was divided, both sides were in dead earnest, he says, in no sense was I a hypocrite. I'm not sure why I was so attracted to that. I think possibly because I feel that way about myself. I think that most people, when they behave in a hypocritical way, tend to think that both sides are in dead earnest.
How prominent is the maid character, Mary Riley, in the original story?
Well, she doesn't really appear at all. There is a mention of a maid who is weeping, one of the few appearances by women in that book, and that's the whole appearance that probably takes place inside of 2 paragraphs.
Mm-hmm. What are some of the opportunities that writing from the maid's perspective opens for you?
Oh, just a wealth of opportunities. She's in a position, as servants always are, to make observations about those who have power that can't be made from any other angle. And this, I think this is applicable in any kind of workplace.
We learn from the maid's journal that She grew up in a family where her father had something of a split personality, too.
Mm-hmm.
He could be a decent man, but when he drank, it brought the demon out in him, and he used to
right.
abuse her and punish her.
Mm-hmm.
There's a scene I'd like for you to read in which she describes how her father used to punish her by locking her up in this very small closet. And this is her description of one of those times when he locked her in the closet and did mm-hmm. something even worse when she was in there. Would you read the scene?
Certainly. After a few minutes, I heard him get up again and come to the door. Then he was standing in front of it, laughing in that way I could hardly bear to hear. I didn't know what to do, beg or be silent. He said, "Mary, I'm opening this door, but if you know what's good for you, you best not move." The door opened and the light from the lamp confused me so I couldn't see. Then he leaned towards me, and I saw he had a little hopsack bag with a string drawn at the top. Perhaps there was a few inches between my knees and my head, for I was looking up at him, trying to think what I had best do. But before I could make out much of anything, he'd stuffed the bag in with me, saying, "Here's summat to keep you company," and then the door was closed again. There was another black moment while I tried to understand what it was I had to fear next. I knew at once that there was something in the bag, that it was meant to harm me. But what it was, my childish imagination couldn't conjure. Then I felt it moving and knew it was some animal, no doubt as frightened as I was. I'd only a thin skirt on, which I had pulled down over my knees as best I could, so it wasn't long before the creature began to work its way through the two thin layers separating us in that narrow, breathless space. I felt a claw sink into my thigh, and I pulled myself up rigid as I could, as if I could make more room, but there was no more room to make, and I think the rat sensed that as well as I. I knew it was a rat and where he'd got it. There was plenty to be had in the alleys nearby, and often enough he'd brought me to whimpering by sending me out for a pint when it was dark and I had to pick my way among them. So he'd put one of these rats in the bag and closed it up with me.
Have you given a lot of thought to what is it in people that brings out the darker, the more poisoned part of their personality?
I suppose I have. I think that most people have a dark side. It's interesting to me how much we pay lip service to that notion, but when people are actually confronted with somebody who exhibits a dark side, particularly somebody who has a very good side, that we always feel this shock. A great case that's been mentioned to me lately is this Charles Stewart case in Boston. Several people have suggested he was a Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde type. A couple of people suggested that they found it shocking that you could go into anybody's house and meet somebody or work with somebody and not know they had this dark side. But I don't find anybody thinking, well, I wonder if I have this dark side, which is how I respond to it. I always think of, I identify with Jekyll.
You referred to the possibility that you might have a really dark side, and you wonder about that. Is it fair to ask you how you think your Mr. Hyde, so to speak, expresses itself?
Oh, I know how it expresses itself. It writes novels.
Oh, well, that's a pretty safe way of handling it.
Yes, it's true.
You've said that you wanted to challenge Stevenson's black and white notions of good and evil. Compare your notions of good and evil to his.
Well, I don't know that I wanted to challenge them. I think in some ways, and partly because of the sort of book that he wrote, he was forced to oversimplify. I don't want so much to challenge that as to describe how it might look from another angle or to suggest other places where the same split might turn up. And I think that Mary herself experiences a great deal of repressed destructive force, although I only found out about this in the last couple of days.
Excuse me? What do you mean?
I used to think that I thought for a while that Mary was not the divided personality, but the more I think and talk about her, the more I think that she is, that she has a lot of anger about the situation that she's in. She has a lot of anger towards her father. In the first part of the book, she really tries to act as if she doesn't feel this and that she's accepted her lot and is happy in it. But I think towards the end of the book, she's beginning to express some of that anger.
Well,
and,
I think she's suffering from some kind of chronic depression. There are parts where she refers to suffering from periods of blackness that her
yes.
father left her in. And that, I mean, that sounded like really bad depression to me.
Yeah, and I think one definition of depression is repressed anger. And I think that is, in a large part, what she's done in order to live. Because in her situation, there's no way that she can express that anger.
One of your previous books, A Recent Martyr, is, I believe, set during the bubonic plague.
There's never been a bubonic plague in New Orleans, so it seems to take place in the near future.
I see. Okay. Now the scene that you read for us, that opens Mary Riley, mm-hmm. has a rat.
That's right.
In it. Were there rats where you grew up? Why are you? It just seems to me you must have this kind of morbid fascination with rats.
Yeah, I've been described as obsessed with rats. I just hope nobody ever sends me one as a pet.
I can see why.
Yeah, I've received some plastic rats that are quite nice. But no, New Orleans is a city that has a lot of rats in it. I've had a lot of trouble with them in life, both the four-legged and the two-legged variety.
Do you? You say you're afraid somebody might send you a real rat sometime. Do you worry what people will think of you from your writing? Because you write so much about the things that disturb you.
No, I don't worry about it anymore. I think there was a time when I did, but if I didn't write about the things that disturb me, they would continue to disturb me.
Do you worry that disturbed readers are the readers you have?
Well, I like to disturb readers. I like to read things that disturb me. Perhaps that's strange, but I don't think it's really that unusual in the history of the novel. A really good novel to me is very upsetting. It changes the way I see.
Good. Well, thanks a lot for talking with us.
Thank you very much.
Valerie Martin's new novel, Mary Riley, is published by Doubleday. This is Fresh Air. Let's see what's coming up on All Things Considered and check in with Linda Wertheimer. Hi, Linda.
Hi, Terry. South Africa and Germany again. In South Africa, the meeting of the African National Congress in exile and an interview with Chief Buthelezi, the head of the Zulus, and someone that Mandela and de Klerk are both concerned about. Germany, the progress toward unification, a blueprint on the part of the four powers, and some reforms that the East Germans are going to have to swallow for unification to move forward. We'll talk to East Germany about how that's going to be. From the United States, the bankruptcy of Drexel Burnham Lambert may be good news, not bad news.
Thanks, Linda. That and more coming up on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. John Kenneth Galbraith is best known for his books on economics, but his latest book is a novel, his first in 22 years. It's called A Tenured Professor, and book critic John Leonard has this review.
Many of us would like to be John Kenneth Galbraith, almost as much as Galbraith likes being himself. The Harvard economist is 82 years old. He has always wanted to be Galbraith, and for decades now that's exactly who he has been, and it's a burden he bears cheerfully. As long ago as 1962, when he was John Kennedy's ambassador to India, he admitted in his journal to some imperfections. His Uzbek, he said, was shaky, and the State Department insufficiently appreciative, and the actress Angie Dickinson had refused to run off with him to Honolulu. But he was otherwise satisfied. His job in India, he said, was amusing and interesting, and one for which I have four qualifications: a grasp of the economic situation, a considerable ease in written and spoken communication, some knowledge of politics, and an unquestioned willingness to instruct other people in their duty. These are the very qualifications Galbraith brings to this short and witty fiction. I hesitate to call A Tenured Professor a novel. Like his unlikely friend, William F. Buckley, Jr., when Galbraith stoops to fiction, what happens is less a novel than what used to be called a philosophical romance, like Dr. Johnson's Rasselas. Galbraith has some wicked things to say about government, banking, and Harvard. He can't be bothered to invent characters as complicated as, say, Madame Bovary or Ivan Karamazov. Young Montgomery Marvin, a Harvard economist, and his wife Margie, an economist and a feminist, will have to do as benign types, talking heads. Marvin knows everything there is to know about refrigerator pricing, but he's also studied Freud and Jung in Vienna. He develops a method by which to analyze the stock market, called IRAT. This index of irrational expectations calculates the madness in buying and selling on the stock exchange. It assumes mindless euphoria, addictive self-delusion, and lemming-like despair. The Marvins bet their own money against the mood swings of the market. By the time he's got tenure at Harvard, they're both of them very rich indeed. And they invest their profits in so many worthy liberal causes that Congress has to pass a law against them. The joke here is that our money men are supposed to be all mind, no emotion, so cold-blooded as to be reptilian. Galbraith, of course, knows better. What happened to the Bank of America and the Sunbelt savings and loan business and all those loans in Latin America wasn't rational, any more than tulip mania in Holland 3 centuries ago was rational, or Jim Fisk's great idea of printing as much voting stock as he needed to control his own railroad company, or the crash of RCA in 1929. Galbraith's also having fun with some worthy liberal causes, a few of them so elitist they cause nosebleeds. And he even joshes himself, referring back to his earliest fiction as though it were a canonical text in the literature of economics. But mostly, he ridicules those complacent institutions, from Wall Street to Capitol Hill to Cambridge, Massachusetts, that presume themselves sober and sane when what they really are is Looney Tunes. A couple of years ago, Michael M. Thomas published a novel blaming the behavior of yuppie bankers in the go-go years on a KGB plot. Galbraith is kinder. He just says they're crazy.
John Leonard writes about television for New York Magazine, is a columnist for New York Newsday, and is media critic for CBS Sunday Morning. He reviewed A Tenured Professor by John Kenneth Galbraith. Amy Sallet and Phyllis Myers produced the interviews on Fresh Air with research assistance from Sue Spolin. I'm Terry Gross.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, by this and other NPR member stations, and by grants from the National Endowment for the Arts and Talbots, retailers of women's classic clothing and accessories through stores and catalogs, 1-800-225-8200. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Vladimir Posner is a Soviet political commentator who has often defended his country on American programs like Nightline and Donahue. On the next Fresh Air, Posner discusses journalism in the Gorbachev era and defends his own credibility. Also, a talk with singer, guitarist, and record producer Dave Edmonds. I'm Terry Gross, and I hope you'll join us for the next Fresh Air.